Today we're talking with Alec Pollard, who is the founder and director of the St. Louis Behavioral Medicine Institute Anxiety Disorders Center. He's a professor of community and family medicine at St. Louis University, and he's the author and co-author of more than 80 publications pertaining to anxiety disorders and other mental health topics, including Dying of Embarrassment, Help for Social Anxiety and Phobia, the Agoraphobia Workbook. Today we're talking about helping the families of treatment refusers. Dr. Pollard, thanks for joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
Let me ask you about what we can do. So we'll start. Living with a family member who has an anxiety disorder can be very difficult. Can you talk about some of the things that happen to a family?
Well, the impact of a person with an anxiety disorder on the family, it varies tremendously depending on the type of disorder, the symptoms, and how they spread and are influencing other members of the family, and also the family situation. If someone's living with that person who has an anxiety disorder, much more likely it has a tremendous impact. But some examples, if a person, for example, starts to avoid things, like maybe they can't drive now, so now the burden for getting the kids to and from school and around now falls on the spouse who does not have the anxiety disorder. That's just one simple example. If a person is not able to go into social situations because of social anxiety, the social life of the family may be impacted because that person is either forbids the rest to have parties or to have entertain at home, or maybe can't accompany them. So there's all sorts of ways that anxiety disorder can affect them. Now, of course, with OCD, if a person has compulsions, they may be involving other family members in some of those compulsions. So maybe the mother of the child has to wash the clothes and wash them in a particular way, in a ritualistic way that is very tiresome and burdensome. And family activities may be delayed or canceled because people are engaged in rituals, cognitive and behavioral compulsions that prevent the family from going out and doing things.
So in a family where this is undergoing, how does it affect somebody when the person with the disorder does not appear to want treatment?
Well, it can be a bit of a nightmare, quite frankly. Now, obviously, if the family member is motivated and wants to get help, then the family rallies around them, hopefully, and they see a light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. But for the family with what we call a treatment refuser, a person who either doesn't acknowledge their problem or thinks it's not that bad, undermines how serious it is, or says, yes, it's serious, but I don't want to get treatment for one of a number of reasons, that family is really stuck because they see their future happiness resting on that person going to get help. And then, of course, they don't have control over that necessarily, and the person continues to not seek help. So all of the problems that are there with any anxiety disorder sufferer, in other words, all the implications for the family, are now compounded by the futility and the hopelessness that the family's feeling because there's no hope of recovery because that person's not going. And that, of course, eventually usually generates into resentment and a lot of conflict within a family.
What can family members do to help themselves?
Well, that's a very good question. And surprisingly, family members, I have found, are often reluctant to help themselves. They're so focused on the anxiety sufferer that they everything that they do is aimed at trying to convince that person to go get help or talk them into it or push them to do it. And in that process, they're often ignoring their own needs because they're kind of stuck often trying to convince the sufferer that he needs to go get help or she needs to get help, and they're not taking care of themselves. And there really are a lot of things that they can do to help themselves. Now, one of the things is to make sure they've done everything they can to present their case in a logical, reasonable way, not yelling and screaming, but to say why they think that person should go get help, and to provide them with information on resources there are things that they can do to help convince the person to get help. But after that, they need to stop and really focus on themselves, and this is very hard, and get their lives separated from the impact of the anxiety disorder as much as possible. So, for example, going ahead when it's practically possible, go ahead and go out and have dinner. Don't stay there and wait for the family member who's doing compulsions to get done. Let them know if they're not done by a certain time. Leave them food in the refrigerator and go. Let the family go out, and freeing themselves up in ways like that to try to not have them be so burdened by the anxiety disorder.
How can family members help the treatment refusers in their family? So, for instance, how do they know when to push, when not to push, when it might backfire? You mentioned, you know, doing it in a reasonable way.
Yeah.
What's effective?
Well, this gets complicated because most of the families that we see are already stuck in a position of trying to push, and they're just getting resistance. And so our first goal is to get them to stop pushing and to really take care of themselves for a while. Well, sometimes they'll ask, why should I do that? Well, I want you to think of the example of a parent who may discipline their child out of frustration or anger, and then later thinks, oh my gosh, I think I overdid that. You know, grounding Johnny for eternity was probably a bit much. But the reason we did that is because we were angry, we were emotional, and we were acting out of our emotions. And then we later had to try to clean up the mess. The same is true for family members dealing with a treatment refuser. They are locked into dealing with things out of frustration and emotion, and they're not in a place to do what they need to do strategically to be effective. And so many times they want us to just teach them five strategic things to do to get that person into treatment, and they're so mad and they're so frustrated that they can't do it in a way that's diplomatic and effective. So first thing, we gotta help the family get less stressed and take care of themselves for a while. And then, and only then, do we start working with them on strategies to actually try to shape behavior in the person who is refusing treatment. And we help them look at ways that they can first, and that involves stop assisting them in avoiding things. You have to pull back all of your accommodations, and accommodation simply means, it's sort of like the term enabling. When you accommodate their compulsions or their avoidance, you are actually contributing to their ability to think there isn't a problem because they're protected by your accommodations. So by pulling those away, you create more incentive. The problem becomes clear to the individual. So that's the first thing. It's sort of a nice secondary effect of taking care of yourself. It starts to put more pressure on the person who has the problem. But in addition to that, you can also try to shape the behavior through incentives. And instead of, what we don't want people to do is lecture, prod, yell, guilt. Those things are not helpful. They just make the person more defensive and digging in their heels more. So we try to talk to them about how to create incentives for the individual to go get treatment, rewards. So that adult son gets an allowance, for example, and that allowance might be based on participation in treatment as opposed to emptying the trash.
I see. And so bribery.
Yeah, well, you could say it's bribery.
Parents often employ, but incentives.
Yeah,
it's a better term.
Incentives, it doesn't sound so horrible, does it? But let me just highlight this, because for a lot of people this seems alien. But the idea is to understand what you can control and what you can't control. And these families have been trying to control the treatment refuser through prodding, through all these futile methods that are clearly don't work, or they wouldn't be frustrated. And yet, see, human beings, we're very good at doing the same thing over and over again, even though it doesn't work. I don't know. There's something in our wiring that does that. But So the idea of giving somebody an incentive is based partly on the idea of getting out of the power struggle, that horrible, frustrating, anger-inducing, escalating power struggle, and sort of set it up as contingencies. So instead of the lecture number 301 for the 400th time, create some incentives for them to go and tell them, it may not be a priority for you, but it's a priority for me. I'm willing to help motivate you. I'm willing to help create some incentives for you to go.
So I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that using an incentive and similar things that you've talked about can apply to children and adults who are treatment refusers.
Absolutely. With kids, I would say at least half the time the kids don't want to go in or have some ambivalence about it. And even more than half the cases, we use incentives. Occasionally you'll get a kid who says, well, I don't want to have any rewards. I just want to do it for the sake of doing it. That's usually the more perfectionistic kids who think they shouldn't have to have a reward. But we're okay with that as long as you're progressing and you're working hard. But if not, let's create an incentive. And it's an alien concept for some folks because they think, well, why would you pay somebody or give them special privileges or screen time to work on their own problem? Well, because they're 10 years old and they don't have the ability to look into the future. You might say, well, you're saying doing that with adults. Yeah, some adults are 10 years old in certain ways.
So let's flip it around a little bit. Talking about the parent and the child relationship, how about for spouses, for adult siblings, for grown children who have aged parents?
Believe it or not, these principles are still the same. If you think about the intervention, you can think of it in two phases. First phase is pull back from trying to control the treatment refuser and protect yourself from the disorder. Stop putting yourself into harm's way where you're going to be frustrated. And that means start thinking about all the things that you do that frustrate you and seeing if you can't stop doing that. And look at the things that have gone by in your life, like you don't go see your friends anymore because you're busy attending to your husband or your wife or whatever. Start to reintroduce those things back into your life. Start to get that balance back for yourself. So that's phase one. The big mistake is people want to go right to phase two, and they're not emotionally ready to do that, and they're not going to be effective at it. You can't be strategic if you're all emotional. So you got to do phase one. Then, if you get to that point, then phase two is starting to think about how could I incentivize this person. It's not always money, by the way. It might be cutting a deal with them. If you'll go to therapy, I'll do this. It just depends on the relationship. So, for example, a spouse, very often you might have a discussion. If you don't go to therapy, these are the things that I'm not going to do anymore, and you'll have to live with that. And I'm going to change how I approach things until unless you get better or try to get better. And I will add to the pot this if you will go to therapy. I will do this. But what does that mean? It could be I'll give you a massage every time you go to a session. It could be, you've always wanted me to go with you on your trips. I'll go with you. I'll go shopping with you. I'll go whatever if you'll do this. Sometimes it's not just money. Or I'll cook your favorite dinner. You know, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be money. Now, those things may not be powerful enough, but what isn't powerful is prodding, yelling, lecturing, nagging. That is not only doesn't work, but it makes things worse.
So if someone wants, facing this, living with a treatment refuser, wants to start enacting some of this, how can somebody today who's listening to you decide that they want to do this, and where should they start? Should they seek a therapist to help them, or what's the best way to start taking up your advice?
It's a great question because this is an area that there's not a lot of resources for family members. We're actually working on a manual right now to help family members. Right now, we're working on the one that would be for the therapists who will then help the families through this kind of situation. I think eventually we may get to getting a manual for the families themselves. So that's to say that there isn't a lot written about this, not exactly this topic. There's a lot of good things on how to deal and ideas about how to deal, for example, with substance abuse. And there's a lot more literature there. And many of the principles are the same. And Al-Anon talks about knowing what you can control and what you can't control. So some of the principles, say, of Al-Anon and those kinds of the 12-step approaches are compatible for the family members. But the specific idea of how do you deal with an anxious family member who won't get help, there's not a lot written about it. and there are not a lot of therapists, quite frankly, who work with this a lot. I've been vocal with my colleagues, and I'm doing a workshop here to try to get more of our colleagues to respond to those family members, because what happens is they'll call an anxiety specialist and they'll say, I've got my husband has OCD or my wife has agoraphobia, and they won't get help, and what do I do? And the answer to the therapist usually gives is, well, there's nothing I can do until they're motivated, but have them call me when they want to get help. And we used to say that years ago, and I found that wholly unsatisfying, and eventually said, there's got to be something we can do, because these families are stuck with this situation. So we started to work on procedures to help the families years ago, and got some funding from the OC Foundation. And in that funding, it gave us the ability to pilot a project to work with families in this situation. And now we're working on updating the manual and then hopefully training more people in how to do this. In the meantime, if people want to call us, they can. By the way, we do this by phone long distance. I hate to just plug our program, but to be honest with you, there aren't a lot of other places doing this particular work yet. We're going to change that, though.
Okay, we'll look forward to that, and we will have this on the ADAA website. Thank you, Dr. Pollard. This is Jean Kaplan-Tycro for ADAA.